unfathomable tragedy in its human toll, but an upheaval in humanity's understanding of its historical movement. The Enlightenment hope for progress led by science and reason gave way to a sheaf of grim diagnoses. The recrudescence of a death instinct, the trial of modernity, an indictment of Western civilization, man's Faustian bargain with science and technology. But a century is made up of 100 years, not 50. The second half of the 20th century saw a historically unprecedented avoidance of war between the great powers, which the historian John Gaddis has called the Long Peace, followed by the equally astonishing fizzling out of the Cold War. How can we make sense of the multiple personalities of this twisted century? And what can we conclude about the prospects for war and peace in the present one? The competing predictions of Toynbee the historian and Richardson the physicist represent complementary ways of understanding the flow of events in time. Traditional history is a narrative of the past. But if we are to heed George Santayana's advisory to remember the past so as not to repeat it, we need to discern patterns in the past, so we can know what to generalize to the predicaments of the present. Inducing generalizable patterns from a finite set of observations is the stock in trade of the scientist, and some of the lessons of pattern extraction in science may be applied to the data of history. Suppose, for the sake of argument, that World War II was the most destructive event in history. Or, if you prefer, suppose that the entire hemoclism deserves that designation, if you consider the two world wars and their associated genocides to be a single protracted historical episode. What does that tell us about long-term trends in war and peace? The answer is nothing. The most destructive event in history had to take place in some century, and it could be embedded in any of a large number of very different long-term trends. Toynbee assumed that World War II was a step in an escalating staircase. Almost as gloomy is the common suggestion that epochs of war are cyclical. Like many depressing prospects, both models have spawned some black humor. I am often asked if I've heard the one about the man who fell off the roof of an office building and shouted to the workers on each floor, "So far, so good." I have also been told, several times, about the turkey who, on the eve of Thanksgiving, remarked on the extraordinary 364-day era of peace between farmers and turkeys he is lucky enough to be living in. But are the processes of history really as deterministic as the law of gravity or the cycling of the planet? One radical possibility is that World War II was a statistical fluke, that it was neither a step in an escalating series nor a harbinger of things to come, and not part of a trend at all. At first, the suggestion seems preposterous. How could a random unfolding of events in time result in so many catastrophes being bunched together in just a decade? The brutal invasions by Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin, and Imperial Japan, the Holocaust, Stalin's purge, the Gulag, and two atomic explosions, to say nothing of World War I and the wars and genocides of the preceding two decades. Also, the usual wars we find in history books tend to have death tolls in the tens or hundreds of thousands, or very rarely, in the millions. If wars really broke out at random, shouldn't a war that led to the deaths of 55 million people be astronomically improbable? Richardson showed that both these intuitions are cognitive illusions. When the iron dice began to roll, as the German Chancellor Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg put it on the eve of World War I, the unlucky outcomes can be far worse than our primitive imaginations foresee. A second scenario places the war in a narrative that is so unpessimistic that it's almost optimistic. Could World War II be an isolated peak in a declining sawtooth, the last gasp in a long slide of major war into historical obsolescence? Again, we will see that this possibility is not as dreamy as it sounds. The long-term trajectory of war, in reality, is likely to be a superimposition of several trends. We all know that patterns in other complex sequences, such as the weather, are a composite of several curves. The cyclical rhythm of the seasons, the randomness of daily fluctuations, the long-term trend of global warming. The goal of this chapter is to identify the components of the long-term trends in wars between states. I will try to persuade you that they are as follows. No cycles. A big dose of randomness. An escalation, recently reversed, in the destructiveness of war. Declines in every other dimension of war, and thus in interstate war as a whole. The 20th century, then, was not a permanent plunge into depravity. On the contrary, the enduring moral trend of the century was a violence-averse humanism that originated in the Enlightenment, became overshadowed by counter-Enlightenment ideologies wedded to agents of growing destructive power, and regained momentum in the wake of World War II. To reach these conclusions, I will blend the two ways of understanding the trajectory of war: the statistics of Richardson and his heirs, and the narratives of traditional historians and political scientists. The statistical approach is necessary to avoid Toynbee's fallacy, the all-too-human tendency to hallucinate grand patterns in complex statistical phenomena and confidently extrapolate them into the future. But if narratives without statistics are blind, statistics without narratives are empty. History is not a screensaver with pretty curves generated by equations. The curves are abstractions over real events involving the decisions of people and the effects of their weapons. So we also need to explain how various patterns emerge from the behavior of leaders, soldiers, bayonets, and bombs. In the course of the chapter, the ingredients of the blend will shift from the statistical to the narrative, but neither is dispensable in understanding something as complex as the long-term trajectory of war. Was the 20th century really the worst? The 20th century was the bloodiest in history, is a cliché that has been used to indict a vast range of demons, including atheism, Darwin, government, science, capitalism, communism, the ideal of progress, and the male gender. But is it true? The claim is rarely backed up by numbers from any century other than the 20th, or by a mention of the hemoclisms of centuries past. The truth is that we will never really know which was the worst century, because it's hard enough to pin down death tolls in the 20th century, let alone earlier ones. But there are two reasons to suspect that the bloodiest century factoid is an illusion. The first is that while the 20th century certainly had more violent deaths than earlier ones, it also had more people. The population of the world in 1950 was 2.5 billion, which is about 2.5 times the population in 1800, 4.5 times that in 1600, 7 times that in 1300, and 15 times that of 1 CE. So the death count of a war in 1600, for instance, would have to be multiplied by 4.5 for us to compare its destructiveness to those in the middle of the 20th century. The second illusion is historical myopia. The closer an era is to our vantage point in the present, the more details we can make out. Historical myopia can afflict both common sense and professional history. The cognitive psychologists Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman have shown that people intuitively estimate relative frequency using a shortcut called the availability heuristic. The easier it is to recall examples of an event, the more probable people think it is. People, for example, overestimate the likelihoods of the kinds of accidents that make headlines, such as plane crashes, shark attacks, and terrorist bombings, and they underestimate those that pile up unremarked, like electrocutions, falls, and drownings. When we are judging the density of killings in different centuries, anyone who doesn't consult the numbers is apt to overweight the conflicts that are most recent, most studied, or most sermonized. In a survey of historical memory, I asked 100 internet users to write down as many wars as they could remember in 5 minutes. Their responses were heavily weighted toward the world wars, wars fought by the United States, and wars close to the present. Though the earlier centuries, as we shall see, had far more wars, people remembered more wars from the recent centuries. When one corrects for the availability bias and the 20th century population explosion by rooting around in history books and scaling the death tolls by the world population at the time, one comes across many wars and massacres that could hold their head high among 20th century atrocities. The following is a list from White called Possibly the 20 or so worst things people have done to each other. These are ranked by the number killed. The death toll given for each is the median or mode of the figures cited in a large number of histories and encyclopedias. They include not just deaths on the battlefield, but indirect deaths of civilians from starvation and disease. They are thus considerably higher than estimates of battlefield casualties, though consistently so for both recent and ancient events. Here is the list. Number 1. Second World War, 20th century, 55 million dead. 2. Mao Zedong, mostly government-caused famine, 20th century, 40 million dead. 3. Mongol conquests, 13th century, 40 million dead. 4. An Lushan revolt, 8th century, 36 million dead. 5. Fall of the Ming Dynasty, 17th century, 25 million dead. 6th, Taiping Rebellion, 19th century, 20 million dead. 7. Annihilation of the American Indians, 15th through 19th centuries, 20 million dead. 8. Joseph Stalin, 20th century, 20 million dead. 9. Mideast slave trade, 7th to 19th centuries, 19 million dead. 10. Atlantic slave trade, 15th through 19th centuries, 18 million dead. 11. Timur Lenk, Tamerlane, 14th and 15th centuries, 17 million dead. 12. British India, mostly preventable famine, 19th century, 17 million dead. 13. First World War, 20th century, 15 million dead. 14. Russian Civil War, 20th century, 9 million dead. 15. Fall of Rome, 3rd through 5th centuries, 8 million dead. 16. Congo Free State, 19th and 20th centuries, 8 million dead. 17. 30 Years' War, 17th century, 7 million dead. 18. Russia's Time of Troubles, 16th and 17th centuries, 5 million dead. 19. Napoleonic Wars, 19th century, 4 million dead. 20. Chinese Civil War, 20th century, 3 million dead. 21. French Wars of Religion, 16th century, 3 million dead. First of all, had you even heard of all of them? I hadn't. Second, did you know there were 5 wars and 4 atrocities before World War I that killed more people than that war? I suspect many readers will also be surprised to learn that of the 21 worst things that people have ever done to each other, that we know of, 14 were in centuries before the 20th. And all this pertains to absolute numbers. When you scale by population size, only one of the 20th century's atrocities even makes the top 10. The worst atrocity of all time was the An Lushan Revolt and Civil War, an 8-year rebellion during China's Tang Dynasty that, according to censuses, resulted in the loss of 2/3 of the empire's population, a 1/6 of the world's population at the time. These figures, of course, cannot all be taken at face value. Some tendentiously blame the entire death toll of a famine or epidemic on a particular war, rebellion, or tyrant. And some came from innumerate cultures that lacked modern techniques for counting and record-keeping. At the same time, narrative history confirms that earlier civilizations were certainly capable of killing in vast numbers. Technological backwardness was no impediment. We know from Rwanda and Cambodia that massive numbers of people can be murdered with low-tech means like machetes and starvation. And in the distant past, implements of killing were not always so low-tech, because military weaponry usually boasted the most advanced technology of the age. The military historian John Keegan notes that by the middle of the second millennium BCE, the chariot allowed nomadic armies to rain death on the civilizations they invaded. Circling at a distance of 100 or 200 yards from the herds of unarmored foot soldiers, a chariot crew, one to drive, one to shoot, might have transfixed 6 men a minute. 10 minutes' work by 10 chariots would cause 500 casualties or more, a battle of the Somme-like toll among the small armies of the period. High-throughput massacre was also perfected by mounted hordes from the steppes, such as the Scythians, Huns, Mongols, Turks, Magyars, Tatars, Mughals, and Manchus. For 2,000 years, these warriors deployed meticulously crafted composite bows, made from a glued laminate of wood, tendon, and horn, to run up immense body counts in their sackings and raids. These tribes were responsible for numbers 3, 5, 11, and 15 on the top 21 list, and they take 4 of the top 6 slots in the population-adjusted ranking. The Mongol invasions of Islamic lands in the 13th century resulted in the massacre of 1.3 million people in the city of Merv alone, and another 800,000 residents of Baghdad. As the historian of the Mongols, J.J. Saunders, remarks, "There is something indescribably revolting in the cold savagery with which the Mongols carried out their massacres. The inhabitants of a doomed town were obliged to assemble in a plain outside the walls, and each Mongol trooper, armed with a battle axe, was told to kill so many people, 10, 20, or 50. As proof that orders had been properly obeyed, the killers were sometimes required to cut off an ear from each victim, collect the ears in sacks, and bring them to their officers to be counted. A few days after the massacre, troops were sent back into the ruined city to search for any poor wretches who might be hiding in holes or cellars. These were dragged out and slain." The Mongols' first leader, Genghis Khan, offered this reflection on the pleasures of life. "The greatest joy a man can know is to conquer his enemies and drive them before him, to ride their horses and take away their possessions, to see the faces of those who were dear to them bedewed with tears, and to clasp their wives and daughters in his arms." Modern genetics has shown this was no idle boast. Today, 8% of the men who live within the former territory of the Mongol Empire share a Y chromosome that dates to around the time of Genghis, most likely because they descended from him and his sons and the vast number of women they clasped in their arms. These accomplishments set the bar pretty high. But Timur Lenk, a.k.a. Tamerlane, a Turk who aimed to restore the Mongol Empire, did his best. He slaughtered tens of thousands of prisoners in each of his conquests of Western Asian cities, then marked his accomplishments by building minarets out of their skulls. One Syrian eyewitness counted 28 towers of 1,500 heads apiece. The worst thing list also gives the lie to the conventional wisdom that the 20th century saw a quantum leap in organized violence from a peaceful 19th. For one thing, the 19th century has to be gerrymandered to show such a leap by chopping off the extremely destructive Napoleonic Wars from its beginning. For another, the lull in war in the remainder of the century applies only to Europe. Elsewhere, we find many hemiclisms, including the Taiping Rebellion in China, a religiously inspired revolt that was perhaps the worst civil war in history, the African slave trade, imperial wars throughout Asia, Africa, and the South Pacific, and two major bloodlettings that didn't even make the list: the American Civil War, 650,000 deaths, and the reign of Shaka, a Zulu Hitler, who killed between 1 and 2 million people during his conquest of southern Africa between 1816 and 1827. Did I leave any continent out? Oh, yes, South America. Among its many wars is the War of the Triple Alliance, which may have killed 400,000 people, including more than 60% of the population of Paraguay, making it proportionally the most destructive war in modern times. A list of extreme cases, of course, cannot establish a trend. There were more major wars and massacres before the 20th century, but then there were more centuries before the 20th. White goes on to expand his list from the top 21 to the top 100 worst wars and atrocities, and shows how they were distributed in time between 500 BCE and 2000 CE. Two patterns appear. The first is that the most serious wars and atrocities, those that killed more than a tenth of a percent of the population of the world, are pretty evenly distributed over 2,500 years of history. The other is that the cloud of data tapers downward into smaller and smaller conflicts for years that are closer to the present. How can we explain this? It's unlikely that our distant ancestors refrained from small massacres and indulged only in large ones. White offers a more likely explanation. Maybe the only reason it appears that so many were killed in the past 200 years is because we have more records from that period. I've been researching this for years, and it's been a long time since I found a new, previously unpublicized mass killing from the 20th century. However, it seems like every time I open an old book, I will find another 100,000 forgotten people killed somewhere in the distant past. Perhaps one chronicler made a note long ago of the number killed, but now that event has faded into the forgotten past. Maybe a few modern historians have revisited the event, but they ignore the body count because it doesn't fit into their perception of the past. They don't believe it was possible to kill that many people without gas chambers and machine guns, so they dismiss contrary evidence as unreliable. And, of course, for every massacre that was recorded by some chronicler and then overlooked or dismissed, there must have been many others that were never chronicled in the first place. A failure to adjust for this historical myopia can lead even historical scholars to misleading conclusions. William Eckhart assembled a list of wars going back to 3000 BCE and plotted their death tolls against time. His graph showed an acceleration in the rate of death from warfare over 5 millennia, picking up steam after the 16th century and blasting off in the 20th. But this hockey stick is almost certainly an illusion. As James Payne has noted, any study that claims to show an increase in wars over time without correcting for historical myopia only shows that the Associated Press is a more comprehensive source of information about battles around the world than were 16th century monks. Payne shows that this problem is genuine, not just hypothetical. By looking at one of Eckhart's sources, Quincy Wright's monumental A Study of War, which has a list of wars from 1400 to 1940. Wright had been able to nail down the starting and ending month of 99% of the wars between 1875 to 1940, but only 13% of the wars between 1480 and 1650, a telltale sign that the records of the distant past are far less complete than those of the recent past. The historian Rain Tagapera quantified the myopia in a different way. He took a historical almanac and stepped through the pages with a ruler, measuring the number of column inches devoted to each century, and plotting the data on a graph. He discovered that as you go back into the past, historical coverage hurtles exponentially downward for 2.5 centuries, then falls with a gentler but still exponential decline for the 3 millennia before. If it were only a matter of missing a few small wars that escaped the notice of ancient chroniclers, one might be reassured that the body counts were not underestimated, because most of the deaths would be in big wars that no one could fail to notice. But the undercounting may introduce a bias, not just a fuzziness in the estimates. Keegan writes of a military horizon. Beneath it are the raids, ambushes, skirmishes, turf battles, feuds, and depredations that historians dismiss as primitive warfare. Above it are the organized campaigns for conquest and occupation, including the set-piece battles that war buffs reenact in costume or display with toy soldiers. Remember Tuckman's private wars of the 14th century, the ones that knights fought with furious gusto and a single strategy, namely killing as many of another knight's peasants as possible? Many of these massacres were never dubbed the War of Such-and-Such and immortalized in the history books. An undercounting of conflicts below the military horizon could, in theory, throw off the body count for the period as a whole. If more conflicts fell beneath the military horizon in the anarchic feudal societies, frontiers and tribal lands of the early periods than in the clashes between leviathans of the later ones, then the earlier periods would appear less violent to us than they really were. So, when one adjusts for population size, the availability bias, and historical myopia, it is far from clear that the 20th century was the bloodiest in history. Sweeping that dogma out of the way is the first step in understanding the historical trajectory of war. The next is to zoom in for a closer look at the distribution of wars over time, which holds even more surprises. The Statistics of Deadly Quarrels, Part 1. The Timing of Wars. Lewis Richardson wrote that his quest to analyze peace with numbers sprang from two prejudices. As a Quaker, he believed that the moral evil in war outweighs the moral good, although the latter is conspicuous. As a scientist, he thought there was too much moralizing about war and not enough knowledge. For indignation is so easy and satisfying a mood that it is apt to prevent one from attending to any facts that oppose it. If the reader should object that I have abandoned ethics for the false doctrine that tout comprendre, c'est tout pardonner, to understand all is to forgive all, I can reply that it is only a temporary suspense of ethical judgment, made because beaucoup condamner, c'est peu comprendre. To condemn much is to understand little. After poring through encyclopedias and histories of different regions of the world, Richardson compiled data on 315 deadly quarrels that ended between 1820 and 1952. He faced some daunting problems. One is that most histories are sketchy when it comes to numbers. Another is that it isn't always clear how to count wars, since they tend to split, coalesce, and flicker on and off. Is World War II a single war or two wars, one in Europe and the other in the Pacific? If it's a single war, should we not say that it began in 1937 with Japan's full-scale invasion of China? Or even in 1931 when it occupied Manchuria, rather than the conventional starting date of 1939? If the concept of a war as a discrete thing does not fit the facts, he observed, thinginess fails. Thinginess failures are familiar to physicists, and Richardson handled them with two techniques of mathematical estimation. Rather than seeking an elusive, precise definition of a war, he gave the average priority over the individual case. As he considered each unclear conflict in turn, he systematically flipped back and forth between lumping them into one quarrel and splitting them into two, figuring that the errors would cancel out in the long run. It's the same principle that underlies the practice of rounding a number ending in five to the closest even digit. Half the time it will go up, half the time down. And borrowing a practice from astronomy, Richardson assigned each quarrel a magnitude, namely the base 10 logarithm, roughly the number of zeros of the war's death toll. On a logarithmic scale, a certain degree of imprecision in the measurements doesn't matter as much as it does on a conventional linear scale. For example, Uncertainty over whether a war killed 100,000 or 200,000 people translates to an uncertainty in magnitude of only 5 versus 5.3. So Richardson sorted the magnitudes into logarithmic pigeonholes, 2.5 to 3.5, that is, between 316 and 3,162 deaths, 3.5 to 4.5, 3,163 to 31,622, and so on. The other advantage of a logarithmic scale is that it allows us to visualize quarrels of a variety of sizes, from turf battles to world wars, on a single scale. Richardson also faced the problem of what kinds of quarrels to include, which deaths to tally, and how low to go. His criterion for adding a historical event to his database was malice aforethought, so he included wars of all kinds and sizes, as well as mutinies, insurrections, lethal riots, and genocides. That's why he called his units of analysis deadly quarrels, instead of haggling over what really deserves the word war. His magnitude figures included soldiers killed on the battlefield, civilians killed deliberately or as collateral damage, and deaths of soldiers from disease or exposure. He did not count civilian deaths from disease or exposure, since these are more properly attributed to negligence than to malice. Richardson bemoaned an important gap in the historical record: the feuds, raids, and skirmishes that killed between 4 and 315 people apiece, magnitude 0.5 to 2.5, which were too big for criminologists to record, but too small for historians. He illustrated the problem of these quarrels beneath the military horizon by quoting from Reginald Couplin's History of the East African Slave Trade. The main sources of supply were the organized slave raids in the chosen areas, which sifted steadily inland as tract after tract became worked out. The Arabs might conduct a raid themselves, but more usually they incited a chief to attack another tribe, lending him their own armed slaves and guns to ensure his victory. The result, of course, was an increase in intertribal warfare, till the whole country was in a flame. How should this abominable custom be classified? Was it all one huge war between Arabs and Negroes, which began 2,000 years before it ended in 1880? If so, it may have caused more deaths than any other war in history. From Couplin's description, however, it would seem more reasonable to regard slave trading as a numerous collection of small fatal quarrels, each between an Arab caravan and a Negro tribe or village, and of magnitudes such as 1, 2, or 3. Detailed statistics are not available. Nor were they available for 80 revolutions in Latin America, 556 peasant uprisings in Russia, and 477 conflicts in China, which Richardson knew about but was forced to exclude from his tallies. Richardson did, however, anchor the scale at magnitude zero by including statistics on homicides, which are quarrels with a death toll of 1, since 10 to the zero power equals 1. He anticipates an objection by Shakespeare's Portia: "You ought not to mix up murder with war, for murder is an abominable selfish crime, but war is a heroic and patriotic adventure." He replies, "Yet they are both fatal quarrels. Does it never strike you as puzzling that it is wicked to kill one person, but glorious to kill 10,000? Richardson then analyzed the 315 quarrels, without the benefit of a computer, to get a bird's-eye view of human violence and test a variety of hypotheses suggested by historians and his own prejudices. Most of the hypotheses did not survive their confrontation with the data. A common language didn't make two factions less likely to go to war. Just think of most civil wars or the 19th-century wars between South American countries. So much for the hope that gave Esperanto its name. Economic indicators predicted little. Rich countries, for example, didn't systematically pick on poor countries or vice versa. Wars were not, in general, precipitated by arms races. But a few generalizations did survive. A long-standing government inhibits fighting. Peoples on one side of a national border are less likely to have a civil war than peoples on opposite sides are to have an interstate war. Countries are more likely to fight their neighbors, but great powers are more likely to fight everyone, largely because their far-flung empires make almost everyone their neighbors. Certain cultures, especially those with militant ideology, are particularly prone to go to war. But Richardson's most enduring discoveries are about the statistical patterning of wars. Three of his generalizations are robust, profound, and underappreciated. To understand them, we must first make a small detour into a paradox of probability. Suppose you live in a place that has a constant chance of being struck by lightning at any time throughout the year. Suppose that the strikes are random. Every day, the chance of a strike is the same, and the rate works out to one strike a month. Your house is hit by lightning today, Monday. What is the most likely day for the next bolt to strike your house? The answer is tomorrow, Tuesday. That probability, to be sure, is not very high. Let's approximate it at 0.03, about once a month. Now think about the chance that the next strike will be the day after tomorrow, Wednesday. For that to happen, two things have to take place. First, lightning has to strike on Wednesday, a probability of 0.03. Second, lightning can't have struck on Tuesday, or else Tuesday would have been the day of the next strike, not Wednesday. To calculate that probability, you have to multiply the chance that lightning will not strike on Tuesday, 0.97, or 1 minus 0.03, by the chance that lightning will strike on Wednesday, 0.03, which is 0.0291, a bit lower than Tuesday's chances. What about Thursday? For that to be the day, lightning can't have struck on Tuesday, 0.97, or on Wednesday either, 0.97 again, but it must strike on Thursday. So the chances are 0.97 times 0.97 times 0.03, which is 0.0282. What about Friday? It's 0.97 times 0.97 times 0.97 times 0.03, or 0.274. With each day, the odds go down. 0.0300, 0.0291, 0.0282, 0.0274. Because for a given day to be the next day that lightning strikes, all the previous days have to have been strike-free. And the more of these days there are, the lower the chances are that the streak will continue. To be exact, the probability goes down exponentially, accelerating at an accelerating rate. The chance that the next strike will be 30 days from today is 0.97 to the 29th power times 0.03, barely more than 1%. Almost no one gets this right. I gave the question to 100 internet users with the word next italicized so they couldn't miss it. 67 picked the option every day has the same chance. But that answer, though intuitively compelling, is wrong. If every day were equally likely to be the next one, then a day 1,000 years from now would be just as likely as a day a month from now. That would mean that the house would be just as likely to go 1,000 years without a strike as to suffer one next month. Of the remaining respondents, 19 thought that the most likely day was a month from today. Only 5 of the 100 correctly guessed tomorrow. Lightning strikes are an example of what statisticians call a Poisson process, named after the 19th century mathematician and physicist Simeon Denis Poisson. In a Poisson process, events occur continuously, randomly, and independently of one another. Every instant, the lord of the sky, Jupiter, rolls the dice, and if they land snake eyes, he hurls a thunderbolt. The next instant, he rolls them again, with no memory of what happened the moment before. For reasons we have just seen, In a Poisson process, the intervals between events are distributed exponentially. There are lots of short intervals and fewer of them as they get longer and longer. That implies that events that occur at random will seem to come in clusters, because it would take a non-random process to space them out. The human mind has great difficulty appreciating this law of probability. When I was a graduate student, I worked in an auditory perception lab. In one experiment, listeners had to press a key as quickly as possible every time they heard a beep. The beeps were timed at random, that is, according to a Poisson process. The listeners, graduate students themselves, knew this, but as soon as the experiment began, they would run out of the booth and say, "Your random event generator is broken. The beeps are coming in bursts. They sound like this. Beep, 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 beep." They didn't appreciate that that's what randomness sounds like. This cognitive illusion was first noted in 1968 by the mathematician William Feller in his classic textbook on probability. To the untrained eye, randomness appears as regularity or tendency to cluster. Here are a few examples of the cluster illusion. The London Blitz. Feller recounts that during the Blitz in World War II, Londoners noticed that a few sections of the city were hit by German V-2 rockets many times, while others were not hit at all. They were convinced that the rockets were targeting particular kinds of neighborhoods. But when statisticians divided a map of London into small squares and counted the bomb strikes, they found that the strikes followed the distribution of a Poisson process. The bombs, in other words, were falling at random. The episode is depicted in Thomas Pynchon's 1973 novel, Gravity's Rainbow, in which statistician Roger Mexico has correctly predicted the distribution of bomb strikes, though not their exact locations. Mexico has to deny that he is a psychic and fend off desperate demands for advice on where to hide. The gambler's fallacy. Many high rollers lose their fortunes because of the gambler's fallacy, the belief that after a run of similar outcomes in a game of chance, red numbers in a roulette wheel, sevens in a game of dice, the next spin or toss is bound to go the other way. Tversky and Kahneman showed that people think the genuine sequences of coin flips are fixed because they have more long runs of heads or of tails than their intuitions allow, and they think that sequences that were jiggered to avoid long runs are fair. The birthday paradox. Most people are surprised to learn that if there are at least 23 people in a room, the chances that two of them will share a birthday are better than even. With 57 people, the probability rises to 99%. In this case, the illusory clusters are in the calendar. There are only so many birthdays to go around, 366, so a few of the birthdays scattered throughout the year are bound to fall onto the same day, unless there was some mysterious force trying to separate them. Constellations. My favorite example was discovered by the biologist Stephen Jay Gould when he toured the famous glowworm caves in Waitomo, New Zealand. The worm's pinpricks of light on the dark ceiling made the grotto look like a planetarium, but with one difference. There were no constellations. Gould deduced the reason. Glowworms are gluttonous and will eat anything that comes within snatching distance, so each worm gives the others a wide berth when it stakes out a patch of ceiling. As a result, they are more evenly spaced than stars, which, from our vantage point, are randomly spattered across the sky. Yet it is the stars that seem to fall into shapes, including the ram, bull, twins, and so on, that for millennia have served as portents to pattern-hungry brains. Gould's colleague, the physicist Ed Purcell, confirmed Gould's intuition by programming a computer to generate two arrays of random dots. The virtual stars were plunked on the page with no constraints. The virtual worms were given a random tiny patch around them in which no other worm could intrude. The one that appears to have clumps, strands, voids, and filaments, and perhaps, depending on your obsession, animals, nudes, or Virgin Marys, is the array that was plotted at random, like stars. The other, which seems to be haphazard, is the array whose positions were nudged apart, like glowworms. Richardson's data. My last example comes from another physicist, our friend Lewis Fry Richardson, who plotted real data from a naturally occurring historical phenomenon, war. Richardson's major discovery about the timing of wars is that they begin at random. Every instant Mars, the god of war, rolls his iron dice, and if they turn up snake eyes, he sends a pair of nations to war. The next instant, he rolls them again, with no memory of what happened the moment before. That would make the distribution of intervals between war onsets exponential, with lots of short intervals and fewer long ones. The Poisson nature of war undermines historical narratives that see constellations in illusory clusters. It also confounds theories that see grand patterns, cycles, and dialectics in human history. A horrible conflict doesn't make the world weary of war and give it a respite of peaceable exhaustion. Nor does a pair of belligerents cough on the planet and infect it with a contagious war disease. And a world at peace doesn't build up a mounting desire for war, like an unignorable itch, that eventually must be discharged in a sudden violent spasm. No, Mars just keeps rolling the dice. Some half dozen other war data sets have been assembled during and after Richardson's time. All support the same conclusion. Richardson found that not only are the onsets of wars randomly timed, so are their offsets. At every instant, Pax, the goddess of peace, rolls her dice, and if they come up boxcars, the warring parties lay down their arms. Richardson found that once a small war, magnitude 3, begins, then every year there is a slightly less than even chance, 0.43, that it will terminate. That means that most wars last a bit more than 2 years, right? If you're nodding, you haven't been paying attention. With a constant probability of ending every year, a war is most likely to end after its first year, slightly less likely to end within 2 years, a bit less likely to stretch on to 3, and so on. The same is true for larger wars, magnitude 4 to 7, which have a 0.235 chance of coming to an end before another year is up. War durations are distributed exponentially, with the shortest wars being the most common. This tells us that warring nations don't have to get the aggression out of their system before they come to their senses, that wars don't have a momentum that must be allowed to play itself out. As soon as a war begins, some combination of anti-war forces, pacifism, fear, rout, puts pressure on it to end. If wars start and stop at random, is it pointless even to look for historical trends in war? It isn't. The randomness in a Poisson process pertains to the relationships among successive events, namely that there is none. The event generator, like the dice, has no memory. But nothing says that the probability has to be constant over long stretches of time. Mars could switch from causing a war whenever the dice land in snake eyes to, say, causing a war whenever they add up to 3 or 6 or 7. Any of these shifts would change the probability of war over time without changing its randomness. The fact that the outbreak of one war doesn't make another war either more or less likely. A Poisson process with a drifting probability is called non-stationary. The possibility that war might decline over some historical period, then, is alive. It would reside in a non-stationary Poisson process with a declining rate parameter. By the same token, it's mathematically possible for war both to be a Poisson process and to display cycles. In theory, Mars could oscillate, causing a war on 3% of his throws, then shifting to causing a war on 6%, and then going back again. In practice, it isn't easy to distinguish cycles in a non-stationary Poisson process from illusory clusters in a stationary one. A few clusters could fool the eye into thinking that the whole system waxes and wanes, as in the so-called business cycle, which is really a sequence of unpredictable lurches in economic activity, rather than a genuine cycle with a constant period. There are good statistical methods that can test for periodicities in time series data, but they work best when the span of time is much longer than the period of the cycles one is looking for, since that provides room for many of the putative cycles to fit. To be confident in the results, it also helps to have a second data set in which to replicate the analysis, so that one isn't fooled by the possibility of overfitting cycles to what are really random clusters in a particular data set. Richardson examined a number of possible cycles for wars of magnitudes 3, 4, and 5. The bigger wars were too sparse to allow a test, and found none. Other analysts have looked at longer data sets, and the literature contains sightings of cycles at 5, 15, 20, 24, 30, 50, 60, 120 and 200 years. With so many tenuous candidates, it is safer to conclude that war follows no meaningful cycle at all, and that is the conclusion endorsed by most quantitative historians of war. The sociologist Pyterim Sorokin, another pioneer of the statistical study of war, concluded, "History seems to be neither as monotonous and uninventive as the partisans of the strict periodicities and iron laws and universal uniformities think, nor so dull and mechanical as an engine making the same number of revolutions in a unit of time." Could the 20th century hemoclism, then, have been some kind of fluke? Even to think that way seems like monstrous disrespect to the victims. But the statistics of deadly quarrels don't force such an extreme conclusion. Randomness over long stretches of time can coexist with changing probabilities, and certainly some of the probabilities in the 1930s must have been different from those of other decades. The Nazi ideology that justified an invasion of Poland in order to acquire living space for the racially superior Aryans was a part of the same ideology that justified the annihilation of the racially inferior Jews. Militant nationalism was a common thread that ran through Germany, Italy, and Japan. There was also a common denominator of counter-Enlightenment utopianism behind the ideologies of Nazism and communism. And even if wars are randomly distributed over the long run, there can be an occasional exception. The occurrence of World War I, for example, presumably incremented the probability that a war like World War II in Europe would break out. But statistical thinking, particularly an awareness of the cluster illusion, suggests that we are apt to exaggerate the narrative coherence of this history, to think that what did happen must have happened because of historical forces like cycles, crescendos, and collision courses. Even with all the probabilities in place, highly contingent events which need not reoccur if we somehow could rewind the tape of history and play it again may have been necessary to set off the wars with death tolls in the sixes and sevens on the magnitude scale. Writing in 1999, White repeated a frequently asked question of that year: "Who's the most important person of the 20th century?" His choice? Gavrilo Princip. Who the heck was Gavrilo Princip? He was the 19-year-old Serb nationalist who assassinated Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria-Hungary during a state visit to Bosnia, after a string of errors and accidents delivered the Archduke to within shooting distance. White explains his choice. "Here's a man who single-handedly sets off a chain reaction which ultimately leads to the deaths of 80 million people. Top that, Albert Einstein. With just a couple of bullets, this terrorist starts the First World War, which destroys four monarchies, leading to a power vacuum filled by the communists in Russia and the Nazis in Germany, who then fight it out in a Second World War." Some people would minimize Princip's importance by saying that a great power war was inevitable sooner or later, given the tensions of the times. But I say that it was no more inevitable than, say, a war between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. Left unsparked, the Great War could have been avoided. And without it, there would have been no Lenin, no Hitler, no Eisenhower. Other historians who indulge in counterfactual scenarios, such as Richard Ned LeBeau, have made similar arguments. As for World War II, the historian F. H. Hinsley wrote, "Historians are, rightly, nearly unanimous that the causes of the Second World War were the personality and the aims of Adolf Hitler." Keegan agrees. Only one European really wanted war, Adolf Hitler. The political scientist John Mueller concludes, "These statements suggest that there was no momentum toward another world war in Europe, that historical conditions in no important way required that contest, and that the major nations of Europe were not on a collision course that was likely to lead to war. That is, had Adolf Hitler gone into art rather than politics, had he been gassed a bit more thoroughly by the British in the trenches in 1918, had he, rather than the man marching next to him, been gunned down in the beer hall putsch of 1923, had he failed to survive the automobile crash he experienced in 1930, had he been denied the leadership position in Germany, or had he been removed from office at almost any time before September 1939, and possibly even before May 1940, Europe's greatest war would most probably never have taken place." So, too, the Nazi genocide. As we shall see in the next chapter, most historians of genocide agree with the title of a 1984 essay by the sociologist Milton Himmelfarb, "No Hitler, No Holocaust." Probability is a matter of perspective. Viewed at sufficiently close range, individual events have determinate causes. Even a coin flip can be predicted from the starting conditions and the laws of physics, and a skilled magician can exploit those laws to throw heads every time. Yet when we zoom out to take a wide-angle view of a large number of these events, we are seeing the sum of a vast number of causes that sometimes cancel each other out and sometimes align in the same direction. The physicist and philosopher Henri Poincaré explained that we see the operation of chance in a deterministic world, either when a large number of puny causes add up to a formidable effect, or when a small cause that escapes our notice determines a large effect that we cannot miss. In the case of organized violence, someone may want to start a war. He waits for the opportune moment, which may or may not come. His enemy decides to engage or retreat. Bullets fly. Bombs burst. People die. Every event may be determined by the laws of neuroscience and physics and physiology. But in the aggregate, the many causes that go into this matrix can sometimes be shuffled into extreme combinations. Together with whatever ideological, political, and social currents put the world at risk in the first half of the 20th century, those decades were also hit with a run of extremely bad luck. Now to the money question. Has the probability that a war will break out increased, decreased, or stayed the same over time? Richardson's dataset is biased to show an increase. It begins just after the Napoleonic Wars, slicing off one of the most destructive wars in history at one end, and finishes just after World War II, snagging history's most destructive war at the other. Richardson did not live to see the long peace that dominated the subsequent decades, but he was an astute enough mathematician to know that it was statistically possible, and he devised ingenious ways of testing for trends in a time series without being misled by extreme events at either end. The simplest was to separate the wars of different magnitudes and test for trends separately in each range. In none of the five ranges, 3 to 7, did he find a significant trend. If anything, he found a slight decline. "There is a suggestion," he wrote, "but not a conclusive proof, that mankind has become less warlike since AD 1820. The best available observations show a slight decrease in the number of wars with time, but the distinction is not great enough to show plainly among chance variations. written at a time when the ashes of Europe and Asia were still warm. This is a testament to a great scientist's willingness to let facts and reason override casual impressions and conventional wisdom. As we shall see, analyses of the frequency of war over time from other data sets point to the same conclusion. But the frequency of war is not the whole story. Magnitude